Poppy was as harmless as a butterfly. Loved everyone he met. He never left the 60s. Didn't really care for the internet. One day he was grooving to some tunes and doing the happy bop when a bullet entered his chest. Came from a Santa Cruz cop. Where is Happy? Shot down today. And it's hard for me to be happy. Happy's in a grave. Oh, where is Happy? He's gone away. And I guess the police are happy. Sadness is here to stay. Now people like Happy, I do believe. Heaven is great, great spirits. You know, like whatever you got here, less of, you got more there. Could happen. So I think he's up there. I think he's looking down. And he's probably saying, hey man, right on. I know you. Power to the people. Where is Happy? He's gone away. And it's hard for me to be happy. Happy's in a grave. Where is Happy? Shot down today. And I guess the police are happy. Sadness is here to say, yeah, I guess the police are happy. Sadness is here to stay.
That's the Ballad of Happy John Dine by Randy. Now we're going to return to finish a segment that we started about 2 months ago. We're a little slow in this business here on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3, at least my part of it is. This is the last part of a hearing held in Santa Barbara on a proposed change in their sleeping ban laws. I think there were three of them, three different codes. Very eloquent earlier speeches we played actually several times on the station. Now we're going to finish up the hearing and give you a chance to hear how another community was grappling with this issue. I think they eventually just sent it back to committee, and folks have been in an illegal status, as they are here in Santa Cruz throughout the winter. But let's hear from the people themselves down there.
Hello. Okay. The idea of what I'm here for, speaking to you fellow beings on this planet, is the fact that y'all sit there almost in fear of people who... This is their bed tonight, you know? When y'all are sitting in y'all's big fluffy pillows and everything. We don't have that, but most of us don't even care about it, okay? If you really want to find solutions to homelessness, to hunger, to poverty, to crime, real problems, why don't you come and hang out with us sometime? Don't make us come up here. You want to know what to do about homeless people in this city, come and hang out with us down in the square sometime and talk to us, see what's going on. Ask one of us if we're hungry, maybe get us a sandwich or something, you know? That's a solution. Putting laws... Laws are soul breakers, okay? Every time you push a new law or a new ordinance or any way to control the public, okay? The public, the human soul as an individual or as a whole is like a fish, and it's going to fight back. It's going to rebel, and so you're not making solutions. Okay, when y'all leave here, y'all going to be thinking, oh my God, you know, what am I going to do? We got a homeless problem in Santa Barbara. Y'all going to be thinking that? No, y'all going to be thinking, I wonder if I'm going to go to McDonald's after, you know, on my way home. Y'all, when y'all leave here, y'all are going home to y'all's big fluffy pillows. When we leave here, we're going back to the situation. Okay, so why don't y'all come down and hang out with us sometime instead of making us come up here in y'all's big fancy place. Have a nice day.
And I'm sorry, John begins with a G, lives on Haley, I believe. And then Greta Lauren, and then I can't read this one at all. It's Hero something, and then Ed Mannon.
Madam Mayor, I apologize for my handwriting. It's John Gibbs, G-I-B-B-S.
Is it Gibbs?
Yes, it is.
Okay, I'm sorry.
My name is John Gibbs. I'm a local homeless person, and I had the opportunity to work as the editor of a homeless newspaper in Eugene, Oregon, within the past year and a half. And similar controversy arose there, and I was hoping I could just very briefly share the outcome of that. Throughout the United States, millions of native-born Americans struggle for basic survival on a daily basis, out of sight and mind of most well-to-do fellow citizens. Homeless shelters and residential rehabilitation facilities have been strained beyond their capabilities for many years already, forcing the majority of the poor to eke out their survival on the cold, hard streets of American cities in all sorts of inclement weather. Millions of Americans sleep out of doors every night, in parks, alleyways, vacant lots, etc. Those with vehicles, including automobiles, trucks, vans, and RVs, park and sleep in them. In most American cities, this act of camping outdoors is against the law due to long extant city ordinances. Any of the poor Americans who have no option but to camp out of doors in the city where they otherwise reside are in effect criminals before the law and are persecuted, harassed, and prosecuted as such with little or no mercy. Such was the state of affairs in Eugene, Oregon just a year and a half ago. It was against the law to camp in a public park, someone's backyard, or in a church parking lot. It was against the law to park a car, truck, or RV on a city street and spend the night there. The Eugene Police Department seemed to put extra effort into seeking out the homeless and citing them. The local courts enforced the strict fines designed to force the poor and homeless to leave towns as penalties and arrest warrants piled up against the indigent people lacking legal representation and ability to pay. As here in Santa Barbara, no one believed it was possible to change city ordinances in effect since time immemorial and apparently written by the hand of God himself. The campaign was called the Campaign for a Legal Place to Sleep. It was organized by the Homeless Action Coalition in Eugene, Oregon. Many churches were involved. They presented their demands to city council in the spring of the year, 1997. Fortunately, in September 1997, the city council unanimously voted to grant three of their five demands. The city would henceforth allow residents to permit homeless people to camp on their private property, backyards, etc. Certain areas of the city would be designated safe legal camping areas for those who live out of their motor vehicles. These were industrial areas. Churches would be allowed to permit the homeless to camp on their property. The city of Eugene and a local county formed an ongoing task force to investigate other long-term solutions to homelessness and extended the new ordinance variances for the next two calendar years. In a recent
Madam Mayor,
very briefly, I recently spoke with one of the organizers of the campaign, and there are at least 12 other major cities on the West Coast. The city councils are considering certain similar variances on the camping ordinances that exist.
Thank you. Greta Lauren, and then I can't read this printing at all. Hero something or other, and Ed Mannon. I apologize, but I can't read it.
Well, hello, Mayor and other council members. This isn't the first time I've ever been to a city council meeting in my life. Wow, that's all I can say. This is quite a huge issue, homelessness, and I'm sure you're all hoping it's maybe something that's going to go away, but statistically, in this country, it's getting to be a bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger problem. And it's not something that is just going to go away. And I'd ask you to think of that. A room of one's own. Ms. Miller, Virginia Woolf. Many of these shelters, it's 100 people living in a gymnasium. At least if they have their own vehicle, they can sleep there in their own privacy, they can lock their doors, and they can be safe. It's getting harder and harder here in Santa Barbara. I know many people who are looking for a place. They have money, they have a job, they have a vehicle. And they'll be arrested or fined if they're sleeping in that vehicle where they're safe, where they're not bothering anybody, where they're not sleeping on State Street. It seems that these laws were put into effect, Tom, thank you, with about fear. And we need to move through the fear. We need to move through the fear to love. We're all human beings here trying to live, trying to sleep, to eat, to see what life is. And I frankly didn't hear anything from the captain that would make me not agree to revoke these laws. He quoted some fires that were lit. I don't think revoking these laws is saying that you can light a fire at the Arlington Theater. And I didn't mean that's necessarily to be human.
I ask you, please, order, please, please. These are civil meetings, and we let people speak, and I ask that you let her speak. Now, please.
So it seems to me that change in my experience here. Change is. And I think by revoking these laws, allow, see what happens. If it's disregarded, then reconsider. But it's a huge problem. Let people live in their cars. They're working, they're contributing, they're looking for a place as land opens up. I love the woman's suggestion about camping and charging money, charging a small fee for camping,
okay,
and living in your...
You've had your 2 minutes. I have to ask you to wrap it up.
Thank you, and I hope you all really look in your hearts on this one. It's not going to go away, and you are in a position of power here to change us, all of us, to move through and make some real positive changes for the future of all of us.
Okay, thank you. And I'm sorry, as I said, I can't read this one name. It's H-U-E, I think, R-O. Have no idea what the last name is. Okay, we'll go to Ed Mannon. Ed is the last speaker.
Hello. Nice to see you guys again. Been a while. As you know, I've had the dubious pleasure of watching you folks grapple with this thing called sleeping. Now, we all know that supposedly, when you're asleep, your crime potential is nil. Well, what the hell happens when you wake somebody up at 3 o'clock in the morning? Have you ever had it happen? I have. You ought to try it with Mace sometimes. That's even more fun, guys. Well, what happens is you're walking around, you're pissed off, you're wanting to fuck somebody over. That's pretty basically what happens, at least to me, from my personal experience, suffering from the boot here because you guys decide I can't sleep anywhere. So, now, I've been watching this, I've been dealing with this for almost 13, 14, 15 years. These laws haven't changed anything. They definitely don't help the cops out. They definitely, in my humble opinion, make me want to go do crimes when I get maced. I really don't like it much, you know? I've been here 30 years, living in houses, living on streets, and what have you. I even pay taxes, you know? And quite frankly, I really resent paying taxes for sleeping enforcement. You know, it's really a crummy way to appease the business community, my friend. By the way, I gotta give them all kinds of kudos. Took them 19 years, but at least they're making an effort to do something here about the homeless. I think we ought to give them a hand, man. So what I'm trying to tell you, if you guys got any balls, got any heart,
you'll get rid
of the law.
Ed.
Thank you very, very much.
That concludes the public comment. Ed. Council members, we have before us a recommendation and a staff recommendation.
I would move the staff recommendation.
I will say that I went through, I believe, was involved when all of these ordinances were enacted. I believe that we had extensive meetings before the ordinance committee and extensive meetings before the council. And in the meantime, I believe this city has done a great deal to try to help with the homeless situation. I think Mrs. Tripp Jones, you probably have in front of you, or Captain Glaus does, the funds that we provide to the various agencies in this community to help address the concerns of the homeless. I think you had them, Captain Glaus, or one of you did.
Madam Mayor, the amount is in excess of $100,000 that the city puts into homeless shelters and homeless services. And currently there is an effort underway of a coalition of city, county, and private sector representatives and service providers with representatives of the homeless community towards developing a new site with a day center and a permanent winter shelter. So the effort continues.
And I think many of us were involved at the time that the various churches were operating as volunteers to help take care of people who were homeless and who were housed in our various churches. This was before Transition House was established. Comments from council members?
Madam Mayor.
Mr. Roberts?
I have a few questions.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were asking to speak.
I am.
Oh,
I have
okay,
a few questions
ahead.
For City Administrator. Somebody had mentioned that permits were being issued to motorhomes for camping on the streets. Do you know anything about that?
Councilmember Roberts, I think what was being referred to is that it's possible to buy a parking permit for the waterfront lots that does not provide the opportunity to stay there at night. The waterfront lots do close.
All right. I have a second question. Where are the unimproved property that allows for camping? Where are these facilities?
I'll ask Mr. Wilson to respond to that.
That list has been provided over the course of time, I believe, to anyone who's asked for it. Is that not true, Mr. Wilson? I think you've provided it to anyone who asked for it.
Madam Mayor, members of council, that's correct. We did some extensive research. It's been almost 10 years ago now on that very, very subject. There are literally only a handful of unimproved city properties in the city, and they're all along roadsides. There's one, for example, that's literally on a roadside. It's right next to the right-of-way, but just borderline out of the right-of-way, so it's not on the street per the code, so it's an unimproved piece of property. The only other one that comes to mind that I can remember of, but you're correct, we could look it up in the files, but this one that I'm reminded of is on a slope that has to be of an angle of 50 or 60 degrees, and it's a small triangle of space, so it's literally not a place that even you could put a camp on if you tried to. So the unimproved areas in town
are... I recall, Mr. Wilson, you prepared a list, I think, at the request of Mr. Hansen, if I'm not mistaken,
several
some years
times.
Ago.
Yes, ma'am.
No, we apparently don't have a list at the moment, but that can be provided to anyone who desires it from the city administrator's office.
You're listening to Santa Barbara City Council debate on a proposed amendment to their sleeping ban, and we're going to be finishing that discussion. I want you to notice how the mayor interrupts the city manager in this debate to cover the fact that he was pointing out that none of this undeveloped property in which it is still legal to sleep or camp can be used for that purpose, to press on with her statement that a list is available even though we don't have it. I actually know about this because I was employed by the Legal Defense Center in Santa Barbara in 1992. It took us months to get them to release the list. We sought out the properties that in fact are undeveloped city property where it is supposedly legal to sleep or camp, and of course they were completely unusable. There was like 3 inches long by 3 inches, 3 feet by 20 feet long was one piece of property on a 60 degree slope. It was quite kind of a joke. We were going to use them for publicity to show how impossible it was for people to sleep in Santa Barbara, similar to Santa Cruz in some respects. Although, as I've pointed out before, Santa Barbara actually did eliminate its sleeping ban for several years before reactionary judges put it back in place, and the city council then followed that effort by renewing a citywide sleeping ban. Let's hear more of this debate. Here you're hearing one of the liberal council members debate with a reactionary mayor, or actually deal with a reactionary mayor who keeps interrupting and obviously has her own agenda in force. Debate on the Santa Barbara sleeping ban.
Go ahead, Mr. Romney.
Thank you. Is it possible to get, and I don't know, maybe Mrs. Bloom, who's been involved with the homeless task force, get some more information about what Eugene, Oregon has done or is doing? Have you been looking at that at the task force? Has staff been looking at that?
Madam Mayor.
Yes, Mrs. Stripjohn.
Councilmember Roberts, the task force formed with the goal, and this again was with the authorization of council, with the goal of the creation of a day center and a winter shelter.
I guess what I'd like to say then is, you know, it is very true that this community has done many things in the areas of serving the homeless. We have a special transportation services for the homeless. We have health care for the homeless. We have emergency shelter for the homeless. We have a number of different programs, and it's important that we do these things, and it's important that they get acknowledged. But I am troubled by the idea that when the shelters are full, it's illegal to be anywhere. And that disturbs me. And there are some ordinances that we passed that needed to be passed over the years and have helped strike that balance I was talking about earlier, because we have a community in which everybody's rights and needs need to be respected. And I may not have a lot of support for this, but I am not opposed to the idea of seeing if there's somewhere downtown or somewhere in the community other than somewhere with a 50-degree slope where it might be possible for people to sleep, where it actually might assist law enforcement, knowing that they had somewhere to tell people, you can go there, where if necessary, you know, the area can be monitored for safety more efficiently than if people are spread out all over doorways in the city. I mean, there seems to be some inherent logic of having people together than scattered all over the community, because I think fundamentally there are going to be people sleeping on the streets of the city, and it doesn't matter whether you make it against the law or not. So if there's a way to say, this is where you can go, I think that would maybe be a better solution or a good compromise. That's just what I think, and I know this issue has been revisited 10 years ago. I respect that. I wasn't here. And I think that there's a combination of things that we're doing that are very positive, but there's something seriously problematic about when there's nowhere to go, saying it's just illegal to be, and that troubles me.
Madam Mayor.
Mr. Dunn. Mr. Garcia.
I just want to mention a few things myself. First of all, I listened to Mr. Boone and his presentation. I must say, very articulate, and it showed a lot of concern and a genuine concern about the plight of the homeless. And I appreciate that presentation, and there was some things in it that I found that concerning to me, that something isn't available. There's other things, perhaps like battered housewives that do have shelters they can go to, that probably there's a response. The one that struck me, though, was that when you mentioned a law that, the challenge of a law, and I know that our homeless or our sleeping ordinance probably has been tested, but testing is one thing, and actually having an alternative place to stay, if you refuse, and if it's offered and you refuse, then you're really breaking the law. The alternative place to stay is what struck me. And it seems that Councilmember Roberts indicates the same concern that I would have about that alternative place to stay. Perhaps if a list is made by our staff, as it was requested 10 years ago, and we've updated more regularly, and if the police department was to say to someone they found sleeping, they had the list and to say, these are alternative places to stay. And if you refuse, then you're in trouble. But it seems something is wrong when you can wake somebody up, and I think it was mentioned by several people that it's not fun to be waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning, particularly when you don't have any place to go after that. But if at least if you're waking up 3 o'clock in the morning, you said, here's a list of alternative places to stay, but that the indiscriminate use of improved city property is something that we don't want anybody to be on, and that somebody mentioned if somebody with a suit went out, and I think that I would hope that person would also get a ticket. It's not just the homeless that we're talking about. It's the use, the public safety, the concern of the people sleeping that I think is what I would have concern about repealing this law and having it just indiscriminate use of any public property, because it is public property, and there is a constituency here in Santa Barbara that one of the main goals is public safety, whatever the perception might be. We're in a society, unfortunately, that has gotten very mobile. We don't longer know each other like we should, so there's fear. This fear of new faces that come into your neighborhood. That fear is real until we begin to become a community, perhaps, and begin to change our way of thinking, that we are a community working together to solve our problems and begin to know each other and look at those problems as something that is ours, not only just yours, but ours. I would agree that we need to get that list and make it more available, and the police department ought to be able to make it available.
Okay. Other comments? No, you've had your chance to speak. No, I'm sorry. We had a public hearing. You all had an opportunity to speak. I said that there is a list, and you can get it from the city administrator's office.
Madam Mayor?
Yes.
Well, what's the protocol that we would need to undergo if we wanted to choose to expand that list?
If you want to make a motion to repeal these ordinances, they'd have to be going, I would say, go to ordinance committee for hearings so that there can be thorough discussion of why the ordinances came about, some of the problems that communities have had with setting up camps, so that you would could be a complete discussion as there was some years ago.
Well, to clarify, Madam Mayor, I'm not advocating at this moment the repealing of the ordinance. I'm asking the question of expanding the definition of where it might be acceptable to camp.
Well, that would have to go to ordinance, too.
Because, I mean, I look at something like Veracruz Park, and I think, well, what harm is it going to do to let people sleep there, you know, between 10 o'clock at night and 6, 7 a.m. in the morning? I mean, what harm is that going to do?
I think it was the experience of people who are in the area that who came and testified when we had hearings before. I think that's... So I think if you want to ask that it be heard again before ordinance committee, you certainly can make that motion.
And I will make that motion.
Okay. What exactly is your motion?
My motion would be to ask the ordinance committee to explore whether or not it would be possible to expand the list of acceptable areas to sleep.
Is there a second? The motion dies for lack of a second.
Madam Mayor, I would move the staff recommendation.
Pardon?
I would move the staff recommendation.
Okay.
Madam Mayor.
We have Mr. Hart has moved the staff recommendation. Is there a second?
Second.
Been moved and seconded. Yes, Mr. Garcia.
Yes. Well, one of the reasons why I probably wouldn't support Mr. Roberts' motions, although I think I would after perhaps I saw a list of the other alternative places, and if they aren't sufficient alternative places, then I would probably consider a motion like Mr. Roberts moved. But to do one now without seeing the list and without considering that, because that would stay within the ordinance of unimproved property. And if we were able to find property, somebody mentioned some of it may have been developed and is already improved, perhaps there is no place, no alternative places. So I would like to, you know, I'd support the motion, but I would like to also like to request perhaps that we see what is available at alternative locations. At that point, then I would perhaps revisit the issue with Mr. Roberts and second his motion to increase the location of alternative places.
Madam Mayor.
Okay. Yes, Mrs. Bloom?
It seems to me we're going to be opening an emergency shelter, which I'm really glad about, at the Armory, and there will be heat and there's a place overhead and everything else until March. Seems to me that between now and then we should look at the list, or Mr. Garcia and Mr. Roberts especially, look at the list and see if there are some additions you'd like to make to it, and then you can bring it back to council on any Tuesday. I mean, this is, and I think it was Mr. Hansen suggested that we look into a safe sleeping area after March, and maybe we can do that, but we've gotten to, between now and March, what we're looking at right now is an emergency shelter, which we've already approved.
Okay, Mrs. Tripp-Jones, will you see that council members have the list? We have a motion before us. Any further comments? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Did anyone vote against the motion? Okay, the motion passed unanimously then.
Thank you.
That concludes that we have accepted the staff recommendation, which is to deny the request. That concludes the business of the council, and we are adjourned.
Of course, the entire business of a list of undeveloped properties, and you've been listening to the Santa Barbara City Council essentially turning down homeless people requesting legal places to sleep down there in November, was a red herring. Anyone who has any knowledge of that situation, including the staff, and indeed the staff reported as such, that this list of places was completely unusable for anybody who wanted to sleep in it. Actually, as I said, it took us months and months to get that list, and when we finally dug it out, we found that none of the places were suitable for any kind of sleeping or camping. So the council knew this in 1992, and this debate, of course, happened in 1998, about two or three months ago in November, and it was another one of these farcical shows, which is so frequently the case with city councils. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your host, Bathrop Spear Robert. And lots of stuff to get through, not much time. We're going to hopefully be hearing soon from David Silva. Before we do, however, I have this promised article, which is timely because of the Martin Luther King holiday coming up on Monday. It's a story from High Times called A King-Sized Conspiracy. It's in the issue, the March issue of High Times, by Dick Russell. I'm going to read some of it. It's apropos. 30 years after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., the public is being led to believe that the case is definitely closed. James Earl Ray, the alleged killer, died at age 70 last year of liver and kidney failure while imprisoned for the crime. A new book by Gerald Posner, Killing the Dream, concludes that Ray indeed acted alone. A report issued last March by the Memphis District Attorney General's office calls the evidence against Ray, quote, overwhelming. All this is being trumpeted by the major media as the last word, despite the King family's call for a federal commission to examine new evidence which they feel would establish a conspiracy and prove that Ray was a dupe. Those same media did not see fit to cover a two-day conference on the assassination held in Memphis over the weekend of the 30th anniversary of April 4, 1968. The remarks of Judge Joe Brown, among others, were not reported in the press or over the airwaves. Judge Brown, a 50-year-old African-American first elected to Memphis Criminal Court bench in 1990, had been routinely assigned in 1994 to review an effort by James Earl Ray's attorney, William Pepper, to seek a new trial. Then, in March of 1998, the Tennessee Court of Appeals granted the state's motion to have Brown removed from the proceedings for having they deemed, quote, demonstrating the appearance of bias. So Judge Brown decided to speak out publicly for the first time about the shenanigans that resulted in his ouster and about the physical evidence proving that Ray could not have been the perpetrator. The judge, it turns out, is a longtime avid hunter and firearms expert. Ray had supposedly fired a single bullet downward from a rooming house window, striking King as he stood on the Lorraine Motel balcony 207 feet away. The supposed murder weapon, a Remington 30.06 rifle, was found on a public street after the shooting bearing Ray's fingerprints, though none of his fingerprints were ever found in the rooming house itself. When Judge Brown ordered a test firing of the rifle in 1997, the results proved inconclusive. When he called for a second firing, he was taken off the case. As Brown puts it, what you've got in terms of the physical evidence relative to ballistics is frightening. First, it's not the right type of rifle. It's never been sighted in. It's the wrong kind of scope. And furthermore, quote, with a 30-06, it makes a particularly difficult shot firing at a downward trajectory in that circumstance. Above all, according to Brown, metallurgical analysis excludes the bullet taken from the body of Dr. King from coming from the cartridge case they say was fired in that rifle. That bullet was originally sent to the FBI lab intact. What came back was fragments, but there was a piece of the intact bullet. In the last 4 years, that photograph, which was marked into evidence, is missing. A number of items were removed from this case. There was one incident where Brown's own court had to send one of its bailiffs to physically stop an individual from removing the bullet fragments from the courtroom. The actual sniper seems to have fired from behind some tall shrubs facing the second-floor motel balcony. Wayne Chastain, then a Memphis newspaper reporter, had arrived at the scene within 10 minutes. He was told by two witnesses, King's chauffeur and a lawyer, that the shot came from those bushes. By the next morning, according to the Reverend James Orange, an associate of King's in Memphis, the bushes were gone. The authorities were said to be cleaning up the area. Across the street from the Lorraine Motel at the time sat Jim's Grill, owned by Lloyd Jowers. If he is permitted to come forward, says Jowers' attorney Lewis Garrison, Mr. Jowers will say that immediately after the shot was fired from the bushes, a Memphis police officer who had been his hunting companion on many trips either threw or gave him a gun which was still smoking. Jowers recently told his story to King's son Dexter and the Reverend Andrew Young. Shortly before his assassination, he says, five men came to his grill, including two Memphis cops he knew. Jowers was promised a substantial sum if he'd receive a package and pass it along to someone else. He opened the package when it arrived, found a rifle inside, and stashed it in a back room until another man came to pick it up on the day before the assassination. Jowers was also instructed to be standing outside his back door the next night at 6 p.m. That's when he was handed the still-smoking gun, wiped it down with a towel, and hid it temporarily in his shop. The money he received, Jowers claimed, came from a Memphis produce dealer with connections to the New Orleans mob. His story gains corroboration from John McFerrin, a gas and grocery store owner who'd been shopping at the same produce place on the afternoon of the assassination. McFerrin told the 1998 conference that he overheard the store owner saying into a telephone, I told you not to call me here. Shoot the son of a bitch when he comes on the balcony. You go to my brother in New Orleans and get your $5,000 and don't bring your damn ass near my place. Originally, the motel room slated for Dr. King was not located on the balcony, but in the courtyard. But, says Ray attorney William Pepper, someone appeared who indicated representation of Dr. King in SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and said he must have an open room on the balcony from which he could overlook the swimming pool, which was empty at that time of year anyway. Lorraine Bailey, the motel's owner, complied and made the switch. Immediately after the assassination, Bailey suffered a stroke from which she never recovered. Judge Brown believes this is what probably transpired. Somebody at the motel who was closely privy to the comings and goings of Dr. King made a call and notified whoever was the sniper that Dr. King was shortly coming out on the balcony. High-level complicity seems to have been the order of the day. The director of both the Memphis police and fire departments at the time was Frank Holloman, a retired FBI agent who'd supervised Director J. Edgar Hoover's office in Washington. What are we looking at here, asks Judge Brown. You had a director of the FBI with a pathological hatred of Dr. King, and a lot of things were buried because everybody trusted Hoover and the FBI 30 years ago, and nobody questioned the lackadaisical, disgustingly inept work that they had in this case. James Earl Ray, who had escaped from a Missouri penitentiary in 1967, was undeniably in Memphis the following April 4th, but he then somehow made it to Toronto, to England, to Portugal, and back to London again before he was apprehended, successfully eluding his supposed pursuers for 2 months. You want to say, remarks Judge Brown, that a three-time loser, an escaped convict with no obvious financial resources and no technical knowledge, is going to not only miraculously learn how to become a good marksman, this one individual is able to acquire the resources to get identities of deceased individuals, come up with very good forgeries for passports and fake identification, and somehow acquire funds for a very expensive itinerary and travel schedule. Then he gets himself caught because he goes through Heathrow Airport but does not know whether he is a citizen, an alien, or has Commonwealth status. Now be real. You have to be the worst culpable moron to go for that story. An analysis suggests that what you've got in this case was a stooge whose task was to throw everybody off the trail. Ray did plead guilty to the crime in 1969 under what he soon afterwards said was considerable pressure, and then after a hasty conviction recanted his confession. He maintained for years thereafter that he'd been set up by a Latino gunrunner he'd known only as Raul. Among other things, Ray said that Raul had accompanied him when he purchased a high-powered rifle 5 days before the assassination. Raul then instructed him to take the weapon to Memphis, where Ray handed it over to someone and never saw Raul again. Last March, retired FBI agent Donald Wilson came forward asserting that he was among a team which searched Ray's abandoned Mustang found at an Atlanta housing project 6 days after the assassination. Inside it, said Wilson, he found two pieces of paper bearing the name Raul, one of which also contained a laundry list of payments to other people and other entities. The FBI quickly responded that although Wilson had worked in the Atlanta office at the time, he was not among the vehicle search team and was creating, quote, a total fabrication. Wilson responded at the Memphis conference that he would testify under oath anywhere. These documents can be authenticated. I recovered them, and I didn't turn them in because the Bureau was a racist organization from top to bottom. John Billings, a private investigator for Pepper's legal team, says that Raul was ultimately traced to suburban New York. We had 5 separate identifications of him, says attorney Pepper, by individuals who are certain he's the right man. One was Ray himself, who was anonymously sent a photo of Raul in 1994. Another was Lloyd Jowers, who recalled this person once coming to his grill. Gerald Posner, whose 1993 case closed, tried to prove that Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy single-handedly, suggests in Killing the Dream that Martin Luther King's assassination may have involved a kitchen conspiracy among James Earl Ray and his brothers, John and Jerry, the same scenario espoused by the Memphis District Attorney General's office. It's typical Posner, says Professor Philip Melanson, an expert on the King case. You look at the pyramids of the new discoveries, and it's all based pretty much on the official record. At the April conference in Memphis, Jerry Ray confronted Posner at a local bookshop and says he pointed out all the lies about me and other family members. Indisputably, Judge Brown's dismissal from the official investigation of Dr. King's assassination shows that somebody has something to hide. Judge Brown didn't always agree to rule with us and was very critical of Ray at various times, says Pepper. But he wanted to get at the truth and open up doors that have long been closed. Brown pulls no punches about his defenestration from the case. The conduct of the Attorney General's office in this case is highly unusual. They had a direct committee formed at taxpayer expense, supposedly to conduct an investigation that resulted in this report they've released. Well, I don't know what it had to do with any investigation, but a lot of their activities had to do with following the judge, that is, Brown himself, videotaping the judge coming out of restaurants and with his associates, sending individuals to attempt to contact the judge and place him in compromising situations. The Court of Criminal Appeals that ousted Brown included, the judge says, former prosecutors involved in the James Earl Ray case who had sat on or were sitting on that bench. They accused Brown of being too involved in personally grilling witnesses, though the Tennessee rules of evidence explicitly allow that. Brown also castigates the Memphis Attorney General's office for engaging in a national campaign of slander against the King family. Some reporters have called me up and let me hear tapes they made of comments by members of that office. It's disgusting. It's revolting. It's a defamation of character. The same group that runs around saying a victim's family has an absolute right to be heard, says Judge Brown, doesn't want Coretta Scott King or Dexter King to have a right to say anything. Last April, however, King's widow met personally with U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno, asking for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to look at all new and unexamined evidence in the case. In August, Reno quietly reopened it. Many say it's a moot point. After all, the House Select Committee on Assassination concurred with the FBI in 1979, proclaiming Ray the assassin. His death ends any hope for a new trial. Still, Judge Brown insists the federal government ought to do an investigation. It's obvious from looking at everything in the existing case file this matter is not resolved. The reason we must go forward is for the children. Generation X is coming of age, and there's going to be leadership which will come out of this generation and the one behind it. They will do things to offend the power structure just like we did in the 60s. To protect this new generation from this type of pressure by the system, we must do something profound so that somebody is brought to justice as a deterrent. A demand needs to be made as to why this farce has been perpetrated among the people, Brown goes on. I'm probably going to catch all kinds of hell for these remarks, but I don't really care that much about being a judge. If I've got to sit there and keep my mouth shut when I see this kind of injustice, they can just take this job and shove it. And that's an article in current issue of High Times. And the author of that article is Dick Russell, and the name of the article is A King-Size Conspiracy. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and hoping to get a call shortly from dead-on David Silva of the Committee to Repeal the Sleeping Ban, who's been kind of putting together a specific proposal so our fine task force on the camping ban can start doing something particular instead of offending everybody in town and kind of letting everybody vent vaguely. Here's an incoming call.
I think you're on free radio, yes.
Yeah, okay. Hi, Robert. It's David.
Hey, David.
Well, I'm getting to go back to Medicare. Hopefully it's over here all right. Hello?
Let's try again.
Yeah, there we go. Last Wednesday, the task force to review the camping ordinance met with homeless advocates. That was the focus group for last Wednesday. At that meeting, although they usually just hear, they don't speak or we don't dialogue really much, they did ask a few questions. And one of the questions that Chris Crone, I believe, and Keith Sugar echoed that, is they asked if we could produce language for a complete rewrite of the entire camping ordinance. As you know, we've been working so hard on the sleeping sections that when Catherine opened up the whole camping ordinance, it kind of took us aback. I mean, we thought that was sort of putting the cart before the horse, and really didn't know we could win that one. But since we won the election, we're going to go for it. And so I met with a few people on the changes I made, and it's pretty extensive. It's sort of like our maximum request on the camping ordinance itself, which includes not only eliminating the sleeping sections, but it includes putting an emergency provision in the permit section so that when there's housing emergency or shelter emergency or any kind of emergency that requires campgrounds, that then the city assumes those responsibilities on demand. And also the penalty section, we looked to that. And the camping in the parks, we also made provisions for when there's a declared emergency, which, as a matter of fact, there is right now. Doesn't seem to mean anything, but it's declared. We also looked at the penalty sections, which are really, 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 ugly. That is the criminalization of the homeless heart of the ordinance. And so we made it that, you know, those who are homeless or those who are covered by the emergencies would not go to a misdemeanor. Anyone that's out there, some kind of crazy camper, happy camper that just decides that he wants to pitch a tent anywhere and he's not even homeless and he's just from out of town or wherever, yes, there needs to be some regulation. If he does it obnoxiously over and over again, I guess that would be, you know, we could understand there'd be rising to misdemeanor, but certainly not a person that has no choice. And that's pretty much what we did. I'm going to present that to Chris if we could ever find the young man. Council Member Crone's sort of...
Yeah, as I remember, we tried to meet with him yesterday, but he didn't show up.
Yeah, well, they're busy fellows reorganizing the entire government. I just wanted to let people know that you know, we still should push for repeal of the sleeping... They're against... I think the Downtown Neighborhood Association made a unanimous vote that they are completely against the entire repeal of the entire camping ordinance. Duh.
No, they didn't. They didn't unanimously vote. It was a split vote.
Well, not unanimously. Let's call it a majority approaching consensus.
It was a majority. Yeah.
Yeah, there was about a quarter of the people that didn't even vote for that.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a good amount of dissension in that group. The steering committee came there wanting to get the authority to speak for the whole group and to, you know, come up with this no change position, what they call the status quo. And it became very clear that the neighbors of the downtown do not want to be seen as anti-homeless, and they were perceiving that there should be campsites somewhere, a safe zone somewhere. There's a lot of perception that was good in that meeting, and I'm proud of the downtown neighbors for not letting that steering committee ramrod that status quo position, because everybody saw the status quo is bad. So, but speaking of neighborhood meetings, my own neighborhood, you might call it the southeast corner of the Fishhook neighborhood alliances, that would include from Plymouth to Market and from Fernside down to Grant, and even a little, you know, the Grant Street Neighborhood Association, Grant Park, Emmeline, Friends of Emmeline, all those neighborhood associations will be meeting at Viking Hall this coming Thursday from 7 to 9. So if you live in that area, please show up. The task force will be there to hear our positions and hear our concerns. And here are demands.
You mean this coming Wednesday, right?
No, it's coming Thursday.
Oh, right.
This coming Wednesday is going to be the Harvey West.
Right, right.
Neighborhood Association.
That's
There's
right.
not too many neighbors there, but, you know, believe it or not, a large, for that such a small number of neighbors and houses, we got a fairly good number of people that signed our initiative last year that live in that area. We're alerting them to show up at that meeting. We don't know who called the meeting exactly and who
This is the initiative to repeal the sleeping ban we're talking about, right?
Yes, the people that signed it last year, the initiative to repeal the sleeping ban,
in
that area.
I've got it here that Wednesday from 3 to 4 is on the second floor of the library. There's a meeting of the task force with the county staff. Then from 6 to 8 on Wednesday the 20th at the Santa Cruz Operations, which is at...
The 3 to 5 is the county staff.
Is it 3 to 5?
Yes, 3 to 5, and by staff they are supposed to include frontline workers, people that actually work with homeless people and work with the community.
And that's open to the public for anyone who wants to come.
Yeah,
that's
the
floor of the library.
The public does need to know that in these focus groups, that it's the people that are being focused on that will be speaking, and the public and the task force are there to hear.
Right.
So we'll be hearing the county employees' position.
Then that evening from 6 to 8 at the Santa Cruz Operations at Encinal and Du Bois is the Harvey West Area Association, 6 to 8 on January 20th. That is also another focus group, but also open to the public.
Yeah, and that is a great concern because, you know, that will be what you might say a neighborhood that would be greatly impacted by...
Harvey West.
Harvey West being right there and any kind of campground decision they make. But, you know, not only is that neighborhood, would that neighborhood be impacted, but the neighborhoods up above High Street, leaning over to the Poganip, might just be positively impacted if they open up a campground instead of making everything illegal all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this law creates trespassing. People, the people and the residents should learn that, should understand that the law as it exists now creates trespassing.
That's right. Thursday, January 21st, again, we're kind of reiterating, but for those who
Please,
don't know,
yes,
3 to 4 at the ABC room is the judicial and, or just the enforcement
authorities, and there will be some interesting updates on what the camping tickets are. We've been trying to get some clear figures on that.
Okay. That
and
should include the judicial figures, too.
Right, I think Judge Yance is supposed to be coming to that.
Okay.
Again, that's 3 to 4 on Thursday, January 21st, in the ABC room of the Civic Auditorium. Then the next hour, from 4 to 5, there'll be the last, apparently, regular meeting of the task force.
Of this task force. I imagine there'll be one meeting of the task force before February 9th, at least. If not before January 26th. But that's not scheduled
and
yet.
And then from 6 to 8 on that evening is, of course, the meeting you mentioned, which is the Plymouth Emmeline Association at the Scandinavian Hall. And where is that?
Well, I have it down to 7 to 9, Robert. Do you have it at 6 to 8?
I have it 6 to 8, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, I called the meeting.
Well, then I suspect
and
you're right.
I did the advertising. So
much for my flyer, man.
Yeah, I was debating about 6:30, but this is a very, very blue-collar area, and 7 o'clock makes it more doable as a neighborhood meeting. So that was the debate we had on that.
I have to warn you that the roosters and hens have invaded the studio, and the adults are all going to be kicked out. It's kid time coming up.
Well, I want to say absolutely the 25th, Monday the 25th, to the auditorium at Loudoun Nelson Center. If you've ever had any feelings about these sleeping mats, this camping mat, please, please, please show up at 6:30 or earlier at the auditorium at Loudoun Nelson. That's going to be our town hall meeting, folks. We need to let them know what we think, and we shouldn't feel in any way that this is safe now that we've got this council elected. They're going to be bantered about, and we have to be there to keep some balance. Please, everyone, show up next Monday.
Thank you, David Siller. Sure.
And that just about takes us to the end of our Sunday 2.5 hours here on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 FM. This has been Bathrobs Pierre's Broadsides with our usual heavy focus on rights of the poor, particularly that fundamental right, the right to sleep at night, a right that is currently being denied under Santa Cruz law, ironically, at the same time as the City Council claims that sleeping is a basic human right. We have an incoming call, perhaps very briefly.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
I forgot to mention for free radio people that Pizza Junction, that's at the Student Center. Just come in the West Gate and go up to the Student Center, you know, up by entertainment, up by the entertainment arts.
So for anyone who wants to come to the Free Radio Santa Cruz benefit Friday, January 22nd,
check out and to help out Free Radio, that's at the Pizza Junction, which is at the Student Center. Come in the West Gate, head to the Student Center, and try to come in before 8 or you'll be strip searched, grilled, and ID checked. Apparently they're using pretty tight measures. You never can tell who's going to try to invade the privileged sanctuary of UCSC these days. Well, I've got plenty more to do, but I think that so does the next talk show host, the Little Red Hen. And we're going to turn things over to her as soon as I get this tape rolling. How you doing, Little Red Hen? You want some time to set up, or are you ready to go? I think she's ready to peck my butt out of here, man. So I'm going to we're going to hear a little of Carol Denny. I want to remind you to come on back 6 to 8 on Thursday when Bathrobs Spears Broadsides either taped or probably taped because there's lots of stuff happening. As you heard, there's a Plymouth Emmeline Association meeting. And I'll try to get some of this stuff out on loop tape, but I've said that many a time before, and I haven't. But do call us again. Do tune in and do follow this whole situation. Call 423-HUFF if you want to help end the sleeping ban. Call 429-3550 pound key and tell the City Council to end the sleeping ban and write some letters. We need you to write letters. Thank you for being with us. Come on back on Thursday at 6.
Acres of condos bringing me down. Tiny little condos, no parking, no pool. The condos are empty, the shelters are full. Oh, let's squat the condos, it's cheaper than rent. Let's squat the condos, that's where the housing went. That's why there are homeless and the housing trust funds dry. They keep building condos that no one can buy. Well, Chevron and Mobile and Shell Oil did great, putting gas stations on prime real estate. Who'll buy land that's poison? Well, I'll tell you who. The rich to build condos to try to sell to you. Oh, land. squat the condos, it's cheaper than rent. Let's squat the condos, that's where the housing went. That's why there are homeless and the housing trust funds dry. They keep building condos that no one can buy. Well, we really need shelters and SROs too. We really need childcare and gardens to walk through and places together so people can meet. But all we get are condos or living in the street. Oh, let's squat condos, it's cheaper than rent. Let's squat condos, that's where the housing went. That's why there are homeless and the housing trust funds dry. They keep building condos that no one can buy. Well, they say economics is what it's about. Building low-cost housing just doesn't pencil out. Well, I've got